The late James Allen McPherson wrote about the U.S. in his essay on becoming an American writer. I believe that if one can experience its diversity, touch a variety of people, laugh at its craziness, distill wisdom from its tragedies, and attempt to synthesize all this inside oneself without going crazy, one will have earned the right to call oneself citizen of the United States. We'll hear from this essayist, who was also the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction with his second book, the 1977 short story collection, Elbow Room. James Allen McPherson was born in 1943 in Savannah, Georgia, and graduated from Atlanta's Morris Brown College before making a life-changing move that eventually led him to become one of the most influential teachers of the prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, produced at UMKC by New Letters Magazine, and today we'll hear the past American voice of James Allen McPherson, who died in 2016 at age 72, in this 1991 show with then-host Rebecca Presson.
The title of McPherson's first book is Hue and Cry, a legal term that reflects the author's law school education. McPherson graduated Harvard Law School in 1968, the year both Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. The author says he decided that practicing law would mean closing off the feeling parts of himself. Thus, he entered the Iowa Writers Workshop, where he now teaches, and became a writer. His fiction, McPherson says, is inspired by law, but deals largely with the middle ground that has nothing to do with either legal rights or basic rights. Rather, his concern is with how people ought to treat each other, with manners or human comportment.
Well, I think that's the whole purpose of literature. I tell my students that the old cliche, once upon a time, is much like a precedent in a legal case. It's saying that a long time ago something happened, which when looked at under the light of present circumstances might prove instructive. I read in this week's Time magazine, a Newsweek, that Saddam Hussein, every cliche he uses is drawn from some story known by every Iraqi school child. So he's drawing on the moral resources, at least the cultural resources of his people's literature. And I think the writers ought to do the same thing here. Maybe, I don't know, not to fight him, but to be aware that stories have power of a certain kind, mm-hmm. and they can transform people. That's a great line in a story by Isaac Babel I talked about last week in class. The line is a story called My First Fee. And the narrator says, art need not try to imitate life. Life is only too eager to imitate a well-devised story. Maybe that's true.
James Allen McPherson's stories are set in and reminiscent of the times in which they were written, the 1960s and 70s. And yet his is a slightly old-fashioned aesthetic. At the height of the Black Power movement and the ascendance of Black awareness, McPherson said that he writes about all kinds of people, old, young, lonely, homosexual, confused, used, discarded, wronged. Ralph Ellison called McPherson one of the most talented and original of our younger writers. McPherson says that he's always recoiled from writing that's self-referential and belonging to what's been termed the culture of narcissism, brought about by young people who saw themselves as paragons of virtue.
And they could exclude others who did not share their age grouping has moved on to racial, to sexual, other things now. It's something that happened, I think, back then, the beginning of a kind of idolatry of one's own self-image.
Were you caught up in that, in this sort of movement that believed that things were going to change, that racism was going to be eradicated and there would be a new age, so to speak?
No, I knew racism wasn't going to go away the night King was killed. I went back to Cambridge just last weekend, and I was walking around Harvard Square, and I went to my old building. I was a janitor there, and my old garbage can is still there. I used to take garbage out every evening and mop six floors once a week. And I had a friend, an old Irishman named Fleming, and he and I sit on the steps and talk, and he'd talk about Harvard and talk about the Irish. I think that was the closest human connection I had in the late 60s, despite all the rhetoric to the contrary. So that story is not based on me. It was based on what I observed in other people. Does that respond to your question?
You're referring now to the story Gold
Coast,
right?
I'm not saying what I'm referring to. I'm saying that in terms of my involvement and the narcissism, or at least the idolatry, I think that I had a very good education from Fleming, from this old Irish janitor, about reality back then.
And also from the fact that you had a combination of real jobs and a sort of idealized education. Is that true?
No.
No.
I didn't have an idealized education. I went to Harvard Law School, straight from a black college in Georgia. I remember sitting in a class in contracts, and the teacher was talking about futures, commodities futures, cotton futures. And for the first time, I saw how the whole society was interrelated, and that you can remember people picking cotton in the South, but not know what happened to the cotton that was picked. In other words, the Commodities Exchange in Chicago took care of that. But so I had a schizophrenic education. I never met a white person socially until I was about 21. And so I had that completely segregated background, and I was thrust into one of the most sophisticated communities in the world. And I had to learn to cope with that, which required me to learn more and more and more and read more and more and more. So my education was not elite. Imagine I've lived all over the country now, and I've been to Europe and to Asia. But imagine my stopping and going back to Georgia with just a Harvard Law School degree. I'd be a lawyer, but I'd be a very narrow person, and my knowledge would be much more limited than it is now. I'm saying that my education was not elite. I was exposed to elite areas of the culture, but with no preparation to integrate my knowledge of where I came from with the knowledge given to me in those institutions. So the last 20 years have been spent educating myself.
So what happened? Did you just have to study round the clock in order to catch up with all the prep school boys? Or
in law school?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I never caught up. I came out with about a C-plus average, which was pretty good considering where I came from. This is embarrassing, but I can see it now. About 4 years ago, a former student who works in the educational placement office here called me, and he says, I've got some bad news for you. He said, I have records of all the students, their SAT scores, on this computer. And just for fun, I looked yours up, and I see that you got about 450 verbal in high school on your SAT. And so I figured you want to have it expunged from your record. And I said, no, leave it there. That's probably what I got.
Oh, that's amazing.
In high school. It doesn't say I'm inferior. It said I had a long way to go.
One of your mentors or early champions was Ralph Ellison. And I'm looking right now at the blurb on the back of Hue and Cry, and it seems to me that his praise of you is almost equally an indictment of other African-American writers. How do you feel about that when you look at that, what he wrote?
Oh, Miss, that was a long, long time ago. And I think, again, during that period, what I call narcissism was just beginning to become normative. And I think Ellison was much more against self-congratulation, self-reference in writing by black Americans as he was for me. And so I've had to pay for that. Some people accuse me of being Ellison's protege or being his favorite. It wasn't that at all. It was just that he was trying to say there are certain things that literature does, and there are certain things that literature does not do. And ideology and literature have no place together. I mean,
yeah.
Strange bedfellows.
And one of the things that I think he may be saying, because I see it in his writing and I see it in your writing and in Richard Wright's as well, and that is a real toughness of mind and an ability to confront both sides of an issue.
Well, I don't know about myself, but I know that Ellison is an old-fashioned Negro, as he would say, and so he is tough. He always insisted that I should not segregate myself, that the best training for writers to be on the road and to not fall asleep, to always learn something.
Another thing that you have in common with Mr. Ellison is that you haven't written a lot. Do you know why that is?
Well, I've been hiding out, so to speak, in Iowa for the last 10 years. I have a daughter, and I've devoted my time to her. I wouldn't want my daughter to read what I write and not recognize her father in it. I want her to know me and my work, I think, is an extension of myself, so she'll recognize me and what I write. I've been busy teaching, and I'm just now getting back to it.
There's a character in one of your stories, I think it's in the title story from Elbow Room, I'm not sure, who believes that the stories are all dying out. That's not your experience? That there aren't any good stories left?
Oh, miss, that's an old book. I think that probably I was thinking about the standardization of taste, the sense that you have to conform to an editorial pattern in order for your work to be recognizable as contemporary. Just a few years later, something called minimalism became popular. And I sat here in Iowa and watched the students go from that fashion to others. I can always read what's happening in the society by looking at the kinds of students who come to the workshop in my first year. So there were all the divorced women writing better stories about the husbands. The second year, there were homosexuals. The third year, the yuppies came. In other words, you can always see the trends by who appears in the workshop. I think the trends are sort of breaking down now. But I think that each group tends to have the impulse to standardize itself around those themes that are most important to it. This is one of the negative things about, not negative things, but during the 80s, there was a lot of writing by females, and I think a lot of Black American male writers got angry because there were certain conventional stereotypes of Black males that were passed on from novel to novel by certain people, rapists, brutes. All those images that came out of Reconstruction managed to resurface in the 80s, and that, I think, hurt the feelings of a lot of Black male writers.
You're talking about writers like
Alice Walker. I'm not talking about anybody.
Oh, okay. Have you read John Edgar Wideman's new book yet?
No, I haven't, but I'm so busy. I've got a...
It sort of addresses that issue, that's why.
Does he?
Yeah. It's pretty much about the dilemma of the Black man in contemporary society.
My contribution to the solution to that problem was and is in the way I treat my own daughter, because I'm responsible for her perception of what a man is. And as long as she loves me, that's all I care about.
James Allen McPherson in 1991 with then New Letters on the Air host Rebecca Presson. His book, Fathering Daughters, Reflections by Men, came out a few years later, co-edited with the founder of the literary magazine Plowshares, DeWitt Henry. By the way, the book Rebecca mentioned by John Edgar Wideman is called Philadelphia Fire, and that interview is also in our archives at newletters.org. Next, we'll hear a reading from James Allen McPherson's Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of short stories, Elbow Room. The author said this story came about when he tried to write an article about housing discrimination in Chicago and discovered that journalism wasn't the way to tell it. This story is about a group of Black protesters led by the protagonist, Nelson Reed, who discovers that the local grocer is charging higher prices than in other neighborhoods. Here's Kansas City actor Walter Coppedge reading the end of the story, A Loaf of Bread.
The first customer of the day was Mrs. Nelson Reed. She came in around 9:30 a.m. and wandered about the store. He watched her from the checkout counter. She seemed uncertain of what she wanted to buy. She kept glancing at him down the center aisle. His suspicions aroused, he said finally, "Yes, may I help you, Mrs. Reed?" His words caused her to jerk, as if some devious thought had been perceived going through her mind. She reached over quickly and lifted a loaf of whole wheat bread from the rack and walked with it to the counter. She looked at him and smiled. The smile was a broad, shy one, that rare kind of smile one sees on virgin girls when they first confess love to themselves. Betty Reed was a woman of about 45. For some reason he could not comprehend, this gesture touched him. When she pulled a dollar from her purse and laid it on the counter, an impulse from no place he could locate with his mind seized control of his tongue. "Free," he told Betty Reed. She paused, then pushed the dollar toward him with a firm and determined thrust of her arm. "Free," he heard himself saying strongly, his right palm spread and meeting her thrust with absolute force. She clutched the loaf of bread and walked out of his store. The next customer, a little girl, arriving well after 10:30 a.m., selected a candy bar from the rack beside the counter. "Free," Green said cheerfully. The little girl left the candy on the counter and ran out of the store. At 11:15 a.m., a wino came in looking desperate enough to sell his soul. The grocer watched him only for an instant. Then he went to the wine counter and selected a half gallon of medium-grade red wine. He shoved the jug into the belly of the wino, the man's sour breath bathing his face. "Free," the grocer said, "but you must not drink it in here." He felt good about the entire world, watching the wino through the window, gulping the wine and looking guiltily around. At 11:25 a.m., the pickets arrived. 2 dozen people, men and women, young and old, crowded the pavement in front of his store. Their signs, placards, and voices denounced him as a parasite. The grocer laughed inside himself. He felt lighthearted and wild, like a man drugged. He rushed to the meat counter and pulled a long roll of brown wrapping paper from the rack, tearing it neatly with a quick shift of his body resembling a dance step practiced fervently in his youth. He laid the paper on the chopping block, and with the black-inked, felt-tipped marker scrawled in giant letter, the word "free." This he took to the window and pasted in place with many strands of scotch tape. He was laughing wildly. "Free!" he shouted from behind the brown paper. "Free, free, 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 free!" He rushed to the door and pushed his head out and screamed to the confused crowd, "Free!" Then he ran back to the counter and stood behind it like a soldier at attention. They came in slowly. Nelson Reed entered first, working his right foot across the dirty tile as if tracking a squiggling worm. The others followed, Lloyd Dukes dragging a placard, Mr. and Mrs. Tyrone Brown, Stanley Harper walking with his fists clenched, Lester Jones with 3 of his children, Nat Lucas looking sheepish and detached, a clutch of winos, several bashful nuns, ironic smiling teenagers, and a few students. Bringing up the rear was a bearded social scientist holding a tape recorder to his chest. "Free!" the grocer screamed. He threw up his arms in a gesture that embraced or dismissed the entire store. "All free!" he shouted. He was grinning with the grace of a madman. The winos began grabbing first. They stripped the shelf of wine in a matter of seconds. Then they fled, dropping bottles on the tile in their wake. The others, stepping quickly through this liquid, soon congealed it into a sticky, blood-like consistency. The young men went for cigarettes and luncheon meats and beer. One of them had the prescience to grab a sack from the counter, while the others loaded their arms swiftly, hugging cartons and packages of cold cuts like long-lost friends. The students joined them, less for greed than for the thrill of the experience. The 2 nuns backed toward the door. As for the older people, men and women, they stood at first as if stuck to the wine-smeared floor. Then Stanley Harper, the bartender, shouted, "The man said free. Y'all heard him." He paused. "Didn't you say free now?" he called to the grocer. "I said free," Harold Green answered, his temples pounding. A cheer went up. The older people began grabbing, as if the secret lust of a lifetime had suddenly seized command of their arms and eyes. They grabbed toilet tissue, cold cuts, pickles, sardines, boxes of raisins, boxes of starch, cans of soup, tins of tuna fish and salmon, bottles of spices, cans of bone chicken, slippery cans of olive oil. Here a man, Lester Jones, burdened himself with several heads of lettuce, while his wife in another aisle shouted for him to drop those small items and concentrate on the gourmet section. She herself took imported sardines, wheat crackers, bottles of candied pickles, herring, anchovies, imported olives, French wafers, an ancient half-rusted can of pâté stocked by mistake from the inventory of another store. Others packed their arms with detergents, hams, chocolate-coated cereal, whole chickens with hanging asses, wedges of bologna and salami like squashed footballs, chunks of cheeses, yellow and white, shriveled onions and green peppers. Mrs. Tyrone Brown hung a curve of pepperoni around her neck and seemed to take on an instant dignity. much like a person of noble birth in possession now of a long-sought-after gem. Another woman, the widow Murphy, stuffed tomatoes into her bosom, holding a half-chewed lemon in her mouth. The more enterprising fought desperately over the three rusted shopping carts, and the victors wheeled these along the narrow aisles, sweeping into them bulk items, beer in six-packs, sacks of sugar, flour, glass bottles of syrup, toilet cleaner, sugar cookies, prune, apple, and tomato juices, while others endeavored to snatch the carts from them. There were several fistfights and much cursing. The grocer, standing behind the counter, hummed and rang his cash register like a madman. Nelson Reed, the first into the store, followed the nuns out, empty-handed. In less than half an hour, the others had stripped the store and vanished in many directions up and down the block. But still more people came, those late in hearing the news. And when they saw the shelves were bare, they cursed soberly and chased those few stragglers still bearing away goods. Soon, only the grocer and the social scientist remained, the latter stationed at the door with his tape recorder sucking in leftover sounds. Then he, too, slipped away up the block. By 12:10 p.m., the grocer was leaning against the counter, trying to make his mind slow down. Not a man given to drink during work hours, he nonetheless took a swallow from a bottle of wine, a dusty bottle from beneath the wine shelf, somehow overlooked by the winos. Somewhat recovered, he was preparing to remember what he should do next when he glanced toward a figure at the door. Nelson Reed was standing there, watching him. "All gone," Harold Green said. "My friend, Mr. Reed, there is no more." Still the man stood in the doorway, peering into the store. The grocer waved his arms about the empty room. Not a display case had a single item standing. "All gone," he said again, as if addressing a stupid child. "There is nothing left to get. You, my friend, have come back too late for a second load. I am cleaned out." Nelson Reed stepped into the store and strode toward the counter. He moved through wine-stained flour, lettuce leaves, red, green, and blue labels, bits and pieces of broken glass. He walked toward the counter. "All day," the grocer laughed, not quite hysterically now, "all day long I have not made a single cent of profit. The entire day was a loss. This store, like the others, is bleeding me." He waved his arms about the room in a magnificent gesture of uncaring loss. "Now do you understand?" he said. "Now will you put yourself in my shoes? I have nothing here. Come now, Mr. Reed, would it not be so bad a thing to walk in my shoes?" "Mr. Green," Nelson Reed said coldly, "my wife bought a loaf of bread here this morning. She forgot to pay you. I myself have come here to pay you your money." "Oh," the grocer said. "I think it was brown bread. Don't that cost more than white?" The two men looked away from each other, but not at anything in the store. "In my store, yes," Harold Green said. He rang the register with the most casual movement of his finger. The register read 55 cents. Nelson Reed held out a dollar. "And 2 cents tax," the grocer said. The man held out the dollar. "After all," Harold Green said, "we are all, after all, Mr. Reed, in debt to the government." He rang the register again. It read 57 cents. Nelson Reed held out a dollar.
You're listening to a 1991 recording. Again, here's Rebecca Presson.
That was the last part of James Allen McPherson's story, A Loaf of Bread, read by Walter Coppedge on New Letters on the Air. McPherson co-edited a volume of the literary magazine Plowshares devoted to the topic confronting racial differences. I asked the writer what the main obstacle in achieving parity between blacks and whites in this country is.
I think it's the psychological damage that's been done on both sides. I think that too many black Americans have bought the idea that our situation is hopeless and that those who do achieve pay such a terrible price for it that it's not worth it. And I think that white Americans still believe that we're inferior. Even if you have IQ scores that are better or comparable, the assumption still carries on. And that's the result of the imbalance. I wish that somehow we could heal each other, but I don't think that we can anymore. I think that, I put it this way, by black Americans accepting our inferiority, we cause white Americans to be psychological overbalanced towards that end of the spectrum, so to speak, and so that their perception of people of color worldwide is conditioned by their perspective on us. So it gives rise to certain arrogance in the world. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
This gives rise to a certain warped perception of people of color in other parts of the world, and it's the fault of Black Americans, simply because we do not stand up. We do not say to whites, look, don't you know this is hurting you too? We don't.
What's the solution? Is the solution something to legislate, or is it just for people to learn how to be more decent to each other? Or?
What I've been doing for the last 10 years is I've been building what I call a multiracial extended family unit. I'm not talking about intermarriage. I'm a single person talking about, in Boston last weekend, I went to see a Jewish man, another Jewish man, an Anglo-Saxon man, a Black man, an Irish female, an Anglo-Saxon female, all friends. I can go to any city in this country and see the same group of people. And more than that, I don't pay any hotel bills when I travel. These are my friends. I've done that for myself and for my daughter. As my family, my kinship unit is sound. That's all I can do. And the degree of interaction we have helps reduce their negative perception of Black people.
So you believe that it's up to individuals to conduct their own lives and to protect their own families in such a way that will make their lives better?
Yes, I think so.
The late James Allen McPherson recorded with Rebecca Presson in 1991 in Iowa City, home of the famous Iowa Writers Workshop, where McPherson got his MFA in 1969 and returned over a decade later to become the beloved teacher. He retired in 2014 and died on July 27, 2016 from complications with pneumonia at age 72. That fall, he was honored by his birth state and inducted into the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame. The title story of his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection, Elbow Room, was republished in the Georgia Review along with his essay on becoming an American writer. It examines the argument before the Supreme Court back in 1896 for a new level of status, proposing that each U.S. citizen would attempt to approximate the ideals of the nation, be on at least conversant terms with all its diversity, carry the mainstream of the culture inside himself. McPherson wrote, as an American, by trying to wear these clothes, he would be a synthesis of high and low, Black and white, city and country, provincial and universal. If he could live with these contradictions, he would be simply a representative American. McPherson added, this was the model I was aiming for in my book of stories. No wonder that in March 2018, AWP, the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, will feature an exemplary Omni-American, a tribute to James Allen McPherson at the Tampa, Florida Conference. New Letters on the Air is produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. To stream our programs or sign up for our free weekly podcast, visit newletters.org. Today's show was originally produced by Rebecca Presson, Janice Woolery, and the late Don Harvey, with updates by Cedric Hurt, Danny Reeves, Dylan Cramhorn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.